Thank you for listening to Fund the People, a podcast with me, Rusty Stahl. For 20 years, I've supported leadership development for foundation and nonprofit professionals. In 2014, I started my organization, Fund the People, the national campaign to maximize investment in the nonprofit workforce. Now we've launched this podcast to amplify how and why philanthropy should invest in nonprofit people. Do you love nonprofit work, but find yourself frustrated by the starvation cycle, the overhead myth, the racial and economic inequity, and the toxic burnout culture that dampens our effectiveness? Do you want to see change, but you're not sure how to address these harmful, outdated mental models and practices, or what to replace them with? Then this is the podcast for you. Every episode, I sit down with fascinating thought leaders from across our sector to gather stories, research, and practical resources that you can use to ensure that nonprofit people are at the center of performance, impact, and sustainability in your organization or the organizations that you support. So let's dive in together as we learn how to fund the people. All right. Welcome, everybody. Thanks for listening to the podcast. Today we have with us Kathy Rich. I'm excited to have her here. Welcome, Kathy. Kathy leads the Ford Foundation's Build Initiative, a six-year, $1 billion effort to strengthen key social justice institutions around the world. Build, that's B-U-I-L-D, is an essential part of Ford Foundation's strategy to reduce inequality, a strategy arising from the conviction that healthy civil society organizations are essential to driving and sustaining just inclusive societies. Before joining Ford in 2016, Kathy was director of organizational effectiveness and philanthropy at the David and Lucille Packard Foundation, where she led a cross-cutting program to help grantees around the world strengthen their strategy, leadership, and impact. Before that, Kathy was a policy analyst and program officer at Packard, and prior to that was a policy director at the Social Policy Action Network, served as a legislative assistant on Capitol Hill, and worked for state and local elected officials in California. Kathy serves as chair of Grantmakers for Effective Organizations, also known as GEO, and was selected as a Schusterman Fellow in 2016. So, welcome to the podcast, Kathy.
Thank you so much, Rusty. It's great to be here, and always great to do anything that involves some of the people.
Thank you so much. I think we'll have a good conversation today. And I like to start out with just asking, you know, guests to tell us about yourself, a little bit of who you are. Where did you grow up? What are you all about? And what has your journey been, you know, to get where you're going today, where you are today as sort of a member of the nonprofit and philanthropic workforce?
Thanks. I grew up in LA's San Fernando Valley, back when Valley Girls actually were a thing. So you can occasionally hear that in my voice. And I'm always going to be a proud Californian. But for the past 4 years, I've been living in Brooklyn, where my spouse and I are attempting to parent two teenagers. During the pandemic time, these kids have gone full vampire, right? They stay up all night, they sleep all day. They only leave their room for meals. So that attempting to parent thing is real for me. It's probably real for a lot of people who are listening to this podcast. You know, obviously a lot of experiences make up a person, right? But for me, I think my parents played the biggest role in who I am and why I do the work that I do. My dad was a crusading journalist. He was always championing the underdog. He challenged abuses of power. He met my mom while they were both reporters covering the civil rights movement in the South in the 60s. My mom's a recovering lawyer, and she walked away from that big paycheck to become a middle school teacher, teaching history and English to to seventh and eighth graders, and that's her life dream. And like, wow, she is a hero because you could not pay me enough money in the world to take on the job she did. But social justice was a really big part of our lives growing up, my brothers and mine, and public service was part of that. And so I gravitated first to a career in government and then to the nonprofit sector. And for almost 20 years now, I've worked in philanthropy.
You know, it's incredible to have two parents like that. That's really inspiring and you know, a lot to live up to, but also a lot to learn from. Interesting.
Yeah, also, I really know where to put a comma.
So are you an Oxford comma person or not? Because Vula is going to come on the podcast at some point, and he may be interested in that.
Yeah. No, I am a complete Oxford comma person. And I really try not to judge other people. But if you're not into the Oxford comma, I really don't understand you.
Well, how can you understand? Because the sentence
right.
is all
wow.
Well, that's great. Interesting. So it's great to have someone with government and nonprofit experience. We certainly need more of that these days. This podcast episode, I'm really interested to talk to you about your experiences at two major global foundations, really, but big U.S. foundations, the Packer Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and how you've seen or not seen talent investing, as we call it at Fund the People, sort of emerge at each institution, both in sort of the conversations internally and the thinking, as well as the grant making and the grants. So that's, I think, where we'll kind of focus. And just to sort of offer some context about that, at Fund the People, one of the things we talk about in our framework is this blind spot that many funders, both as individuals, but also as institutions, foundations, even government grant makers as well. But here we're focused on foundations. This blind spot where they don't actually see the pain that nonprofit folks experience from a lack of investment in them. And they don't see it as the funders often don't see the issue, the problem, or the value proposition of investing in the staff at grantee institutions or fields of work that the foundations support. And it's sort of this vicious cycle where funders aren't taught to see this as part of their job, and in fact often disincentivize it by sort of thinking about compensation and benefits and professional development and HR infrastructure as sort of overhead, which everyone's been taught to minimize. And so those sort of both the lack of interest that folks perceive from foundations and the disincentivization of investing in staff leads nonprofit folks to say, okay, they're not interested in that. They're interested in, you know, financial health. They're interested in strategy. And so we'll talk about those things, and we won't sort of expose or ask for these things. So there becomes this artificially low demand for investments in the staff, which reinforces the blind spot. So that's sort of the framing we've put out there around this blind spot and the need to sort of break that cycle, which everyone in that cycle has a role in breaking. So certainly funders have a lot of power to do so. So you've been at these two major foundations that have each in their own way attempted to address organizational effectiveness, capacity building, and within that, to some extent, leadership and staffing issues. So let's take them one at a time. Let's start with the David and Lucille Packard Foundation, which is where you were when we met.
That's right. So the project I thought I'd talk about from my time at Packard, because it really taught me a lot and really changed my own practice as a funder. It was called the Community Leadership Project, or CLP. And it started out as a 3-year initiative, but became a 6-year initiative. And it was a collaboration of 3 California-based foundations. So the David and Lucille Packard Foundation, the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation and the James Irvine Foundation. And the idea was to strengthen grassroots groups that were serving low-income communities of color in California. And what we wanted to do was give these organizations, most of which were POC-led, 3 years of unrestricted support, so support to actually run their organizations, plus additional capacity-building services, including leadership development. And we thought that this would help them become more powerful and more sustainable. And it doesn't sound all that revolutionary today, but we were doing this back in 2009, and it was kind of a big deal for big foundations to do this kind of work. One of the areas we invested in heavily was leadership development. We had 10 different leadership development programs that we worked with as part of that initiative, so that we basically gave all of the grantees a menu. And we said, here, if you're interested in leadership development, here are 10 programs that we have vetted, and you can participate in one of them. You could even participate in more than one of them. A few of them participated in a couple. And they were organizations, leadership development programs like Rockwood or LeaderSpring or WindCall, which is a sabbatical program. And we specifically chose programs that specialized in nurturing leaders of color, women, and LGBTQ people. All told, we ended up investing $22 million over the 6 years in these organizations. About 100 different organizations received funding through the program at one time or another. And like I said, I learned a lot of lessons from this project, which later on I was able to apply on a much grander scale to the BUILD program at the Ford Foundation. So just to say what a few of those were, the first and the most important was the value of listening deeply to those who are actually leading the change and co-creating with them. And in the Community Leadership Project, we made some dramatic changes to the initiative in the second 3 years. For example, we doubled or even tripled the amount of general support that the grantees received. We really pared back the capacity building and focused it more on quality than on quantity and just offering a bunch of things. And most importantly, we chose to work more deeply with fewer organizations. And we did all of this because we really engaged with our grantee partners about what would be most helpful for them. And then we took their advice, right? So that was the first big lesson. The second lesson was the value of flexible multi-year operating support combined with capacity building. Actually, I hadn't done a lot of that before in my career. The third lesson was the need for support to be significant enough to make a difference. So in the first 3 years of the Community Leadership Project, our general support grants were pretty small. And in the second phase, in response to that feedback back and input, we made those grants much larger, even though it meant we could work with fewer. We were working with them more meaningfully. We were giving them support that helped them to keep their doors open. And then the fourth lesson, and really the lesson for today, was the need to truly invest in and support nonprofit talent. So for many of the CLP grantees, they started off the program with few or no paid staff. And the general support grants enabled them to pay decent salaries for the first time. And for the leaders who took us up on our offer of leadership programs, those programs proved to be really transformational for them. So if you want to learn more about CLP, by the way, the initiative website is still up and running, even though that initiative concluded a couple years ago. It's at communityleadershipproject.org, and it includes evaluations, lessons learned, there are cool graphics, there's some videos, you can go have fun with it.
I'm sure folks will go have fun with it. So can you just repeat that URL again for everyone?
Sure. CommunityLeadershipProject, all one word, .org.
Great. And we'll include that in the show notes, of course, along with other things that get mentioned. Wow, that's great. I sort of hadn't heard those lessons learned from that initiative. And that's, you know, those are three major, I guess Irvine is what, statewide, and then Hewlett and Packard are sort of global. So it must, is it pretty unusual to focus on, you know, the region like that, the state for those bigger foundations?
Yes, I think especially for Hewlett and Packard, it was. Irvine, being a state-based funder, does work more deeply in regions. But for all of us, it was really new to work with grassroots groups. It wasn't something that any of the three of us had done really deeply before. And we learned a lot from it, and a lot of it was very humbling, right? You come in as a funder and you've got your kind of expert hat on. Most program officers are hired as content experts in their field, and I liked to think I was one, right? And so realizing that, no, we have a lot to learn. We do have significant blind spots. We're better when we listen to community and when we listen to the people that we're trying to serve and whose lives we're trying to affect for the better. That sounds, again, really obvious looking back on it now, but at the time it was pretty life-changing for me. And I think I got a lot better at my own job when I let go of the idea that I had to be an expert.
Yeah, it's a lot of pressure to be an expert, especially when you're that in that position of making recommendations and decisions.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of foundation staff are not experts in nonprofits, right? So you talk about the blind spot. And a lot of them, a surprising number of them, have never worked in a nonprofit before. They've been in government, or they've been in academia, or they've been in the private sector, like the consulting world. They don't know what it's like to have to worry about, if I don't make payroll, if I don't get this grant, I don't make payroll, and I've got to lay people off. They don't know what it's like to get that $10,000 check kind of out of the blue and realize, oh my gosh, it means I can stay in business for 3 more weeks, right? I'd had some of that because I'd spent a couple years in a very small, scrappy nonprofit and ultimately had to close its doors during the Great Recession in 2008. So I knew some of it, but I'm really surprised at how often people in the philanthropic world just don't have a real understanding of nonprofit work and all that it takes to do it well.
And, you know, Center for Effective Philanthropy has found that that listening, I think it's paired listening and then responding, you know, is really a crucial skill for being a good grant maker. And we're often trained, or we just think it's our job as grant makers to assert a strategy. You know, there's all this stuff about strategy and to assert that knowledge and that strategy rather than sort of being in that responsive mode. So that's really interesting. And one thing I've certainly picked up on, I think, at from the people over the last number of years is that these issues of staffing can really rise up when there is that listening mode. And when there's a place-based approach, it seems to happen more rather than sort of national or global, because you kind of get to know those groups and you don't have as many choices. You can't say, oh, that group isn't so effective, so we'll just jump over to this other country or, you know, state and fund this other thing. There's a pool of talent, there's a pool of staff, and those are the people who are running the organizations that you're supporting. So I think it creates an interesting, different kind of dynamic.
It's also different in place because those nonprofit leaders are not some abstract, right? They might be your neighbors. They might be, their kids might be in school with yours, right? They're a part of your community. And you're all, you know, it's sort of human nature to trust who you know, right? Mm. But I think particularly when you're a national or global funder, the challenge is to build trust and relationship with those you don't know, right? And to be open to their ideas. And I think that there's a long way to go for many, many people who are working in philanthropy to realize how important that is to do.
Well, you've given us a great segue for the next portion, but let's, before we go there, we'll keep everyone waiting with bated breath. So let's take a quick break. We'll be right back. More with Kathy. Fund the People podcast is brought to you by Fund the People, the national campaign to maximize investment in America's nonprofit workforce. You can find Fund the People online at fundthepeople.org and follow us on Twitter at Fund the People. We're fiscally sponsored by community partners. If you're ever in need of an incubator for a nonprofit project, they're great, and you can find them at communitypartners.org. Today, I want to invite you to consider sponsoring this podcast. We are open to sponsorship from mission-aligned foundations, consulting practices, search firms, nonprofits, and businesses. If you're interested, email me, rusty@fundthepeople.org, or give me a call at 845-288-0176. Since this podcast is in its early days, I want to do something unusual here. I want to acknowledge not just our current supporters, but all the institutions that have ever provided grant support to Fund the People since we began R&D through our residency at the NYU Wagner School in 2013. Here's all the funders that have ever supported Fund the People with a grant: American Express, Annie E. Casey Foundation, Barr Foundation, Bush Foundation, David and Lucille Packard Foundation, Deutsche Bank America's Foundation, Durfee Foundation, Evelyn and Walter Haas Jr. Fund, Ford Foundation, Kresge Foundation, Newman's Own Foundation, Public Welfare Foundation, Robert Sterling Clark Foundation, Tides Foundation, William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, W.K. Kellogg Foundation. Special double shout out to the team at the Kresge Foundation. They are the only funder that has supported Fund the People continuously with back-to-back grants since 2014. My sincere thanks to all these generous supporters for their investments in the work of Fund the People. Okay, we're back. So speaking of sort of global building trust and building relationships around the world, at the Ford Foundation, you've been leading BUILD, and I can't believe it's been, what, 4 or 5 years now?
4 years, yeah. It's really hard for me to believe, too. I was really happy living my life in California. But the Ford Foundation has some other plans.
Little did you know, you were walking into pre-pandemic New York City when you moved
That's
here.
Right. Wow. Yeah, I, you know, it's not the first time in my life where I've lived through like a big historic moment. And the thing about living through big historic moments is they're overrated. You just don't really want to live through them.
Well, I'm hoping by the time this airs that this will all be behind us. We'll see.
I hope so too.
tell our listeners about BUILD overall and how it came about. Let's start with how it came about. I mean, there's an interesting, I was just looking at Darren's blog and he was talking about Ford Forward like 5 years ago, summer, 5 years ago.
Yeah. So the Ford Foundation is obviously a very large legacy foundation. I mean, it's been a legacy foundation means it's been around a really long time and it lives off of its endowment, right? And Rusty actually worked there long before I did. So,
Just in a junior role, but yeah, that's true.
But one of the things that people at Ford have learned over 80 years of making grants is that social justice organizations around the world are playing a really long game, right? If you're trying to change political, economic, and social systems to end inequality, your success is going to be measured not in minutes or in days, but in years or in decades. Right? And progress isn't linear either. It's characterized by setbacks, defeat, really well-funded opposition. And unfortunately, the way that the nonprofit sector is financed in the 21st century actually makes it harder to play the long game, right? It makes it harder for leaders to develop. It makes it harder for institutions to thrive. And it makes it harder for groundbreaking ideas to take hold when you are raising money one grant at a time, 1 year at a time. And when nonprofits find themselves dependent on short-term and highly restricted grants, and they're tied to these very rigid timeframes and deliverables that they didn't even have a hand in setting, it really keeps nonprofits on this treadmill of short-term thinking. They're afraid to innovate. They're afraid to take risks. They're afraid to learn from failure because they have to constantly be thinking about the next grant, which will allow them to pay their people. And it also keeps nonprofit workers underpaid and overworked and doubtful about the viability of nonprofit careers. It's even more difficult for women and people of color. But I have to say, like, would I have been able to stick it out in nonprofit work and get to the, you know, cushy foundation job if I didn't have a spouse who was also earning a salary? Probably not, right? Like, it would have been really hard. I couldn't have paid off my loans and done all those things. So the Ford Foundation has come to realize that we were part of that problem, right? In 2015, which was the year before Build started, two-thirds of all Ford Foundation grant-making were project grants. And organizations might get funded by Ford year after year after year, but they were getting funded a year at a time, right, for very specific things. So Darren Walker and Hillary Pennington came along as leaders of the Ford Foundation, and they decided to change this. And in late 2015, so you're right, Rusty, it was just about 5 years ago, the foundation announced Ford Forward, which was an initiative to change the way that we do business. And some of those key elements meant making more of our grants general or core support. So in 2015, 36% of the grant making was general or core support. In 2019, it was 76%. So that's a big change. We committed to paying a minimum of 20% indirect cost on all our project grants. And then we launched the program that I left California for, which is Building Institutions and Networks, or BUILD. And as you said at the top of the podcast, BUILD's goal is to strengthen key institutions around the world that fight inequality. And it also aims to shift that power dynamic between donors and grantees by making Ford Foundation's relationship with these organizations more collaborative and more strategic and more trusting. So there are five core elements to the BUILD program. We currently have about 340 organizations in the program from 32 different countries. Each one of them gets general operating support for a full 5 years. They go through an assessment that helps them to organize and prioritize their own institutional strengthening needs. And then they get money for institutional strengthening. So they take what they learn in that assessment, they use it to develop their own priorities, they invest in those priorities over the 5 years. The fourth component is peer learning. And we're working with grantees right now in peer learning cohorts around women's leadership, financial sustainability, digital security. We just started one with Fund the People on talent management in times of COVID. And then the fifth component is rigorous evaluation, right? So this is a really diverse set of organizations within BUILD. They are advocacy groups, they are grassroots groups, they are think tanks, litigators, intermediaries, narrative change organizations. The largest organization has an annual budget in the tens of millions of dollars a year. The smallest has an annual budget of less than $500,000. And a majority of the BUILD organizations around the world are led by women. In the US, close to half are led by people of color. So it's a really big, I call it the octopus. It kind of reaches into everything. But it's been the privilege of my life to work with a lot of people at Ford to stand up this program and to try to fundamentally reimagine the way we make grants at Ford.
It is a privilege to work at Ford Foundation, and it's certainly a privilege to work with the grantee, the amazing groups that get raise money from Ford. And so, yeah, this is an incredible opportunity. I think you're right. It's kind of mind blowing, not just to work there, but to help transform, kind of incubate this new way of doing things at Ford. And It seems pretty explicit. You guys have said so. This is an experiment, an incubation of how we might do this. That's sort of, and it's a pretty big scale to start with. It's not.
Yeah.
You ain't starting with 10 groups.
You should not ask me to name all 340.
Who's your favorite? Come on.
Oh, I don't know. That's like the most dangerous question. I have to admit, I do have some sentimental favorites, but I'm gonna keep that one to myself.
No. We will edit that all completely out. Maybe. I don't know. We'll see. We're thrilled to be part of this cohort experience with some of the groups. And I had a chance with my colleagues to talk with some of the consultants who've been facilitating other cohorts. I think the financial sustainability one and I believe it was one on diversity, equity, and inclusion. And it was fascinating to hear their experiences also working with the groups. But I want to make sure folks know you mentioned the organizational assessment tool, and I believe it's open source.
It is.
So I want you to just share with everyone both the tool and the process that groups go through.
Yeah, so it's a free open source tool. Anyone can use it. It's available through the build page on the Ford Foundation website, and it's translated into 6 languages, maybe 7 languages, but I think 6 languages. And it's a facilitated assessment. So we have vetted and trained up about 120 facilitators around the world who are well-versed in using this tool. And organizations go through the process with a facilitator. The other cool thing about it, it developed as a consensus-based tool. So it's not something you take on paper and the facilitator just kind of tells you what your results are. You actually sit in a room with all of your colleagues. And talk about where you think the organization is. And everyone has a voice in that conversation. So it is not something that's frequently an organizational assessment is just done by the CEO or just done by the leadership team. This is done by every worker in the nonprofit, or if the nonprofit is really big, it's done by a representative sample, and everyone's voice matters. That felt important to us because we're a social justice foundation. But I think it's really interesting to note that when the build organizations took this assessment, more than half of them ended up saying and said, as an organization, what are our top priorities to strengthen ourselves over the 5 years? More than half chose human resources and talent or organizational culture as one of their top 3 priorities. And in many cases, they pick both as their top priorities. So the human resources and talent section asks questions about things like HR policies, job descriptions and appraisals, compensation, staff development, turnover, staff diversity. The organizational culture questions cover issues like internal communications, processes for decision-making, staff well-being, and whether the organization reflects a strong commitment to equity and inclusion, you know, both in its own operations and in its work in the world. So what these assessments, what organizations were learning through these assessments is exactly what you talk about, Rusty. The most important thing for them to invest in is their people and how their people experience their work. And that was, it shouldn't have been surprising to us, but it was maybe a little bit surprising, you know?
Yeah, because it's not the way things were done. I mean, and it's not what people get to talk about. So you sort of created this, not to overstate it, but I think you kind of, other funders do it in different ways, but you created a space where they had that facilitated space, not directly with the funders, but with these 120. That's amazing. Consultants or facilitators who could help their organization go through this. And the fact that it wasn't just an executive director or a development director, but all these stakeholders, I think also creates a difference because there's obviously power dynamics within a nonprofit about who gets voice the needs of the organization to their funders. And so you sort of tackle both in a way through that. And it's interesting that that enabled, or that listening process lifted up these issues.
Yeah, I think the other important thing to note was we played, like, as the foundation, we took ourselves completely out of that process. So not only were we not present for any of the organizational assessments, but we didn't require grantees to share their reports and findings back with us. We said, share it if you like. We would love to see it. It will help us understand you better. But we recognize that anytime you sit down and talk about what's working and what's not in an organization, a lot of stuff is going to come up, right? Mm-hmm. And some of it's going to be intensely personal, and you might not want to share it with the Ford Foundation. And so that's okay. And so we know that these are priorities because organizations send their report to a third-party vendor who anonymizes them and gives us trend data only. But we don't... we're not there wagging our fingers saying, well, you know, 60% of your staff says they're deeply unhappy with the way that you compensate them, and what are you going to do about that? We really support the organization, and we give them resources, both money and access to peer learning and capacity building cohorts to help them figure out their own best path.
I often say to nonprofits, you know, your funders don't want to punish you for your flaws or your shortcomings. They want to help you. So if you go to them with a problem, they're not gonna say, oh, if they're investing in you already, they want you to succeed. So can you enroll them as an ally in addressing the issue? Then you're coming from a place of, you know, sort of strength, you know, strategic vulnerability, but not weakness, you know? And I always say, like, funders can sniff out BS anyway. So they probably already know that their job is. So you might as well have the conversation and see how they can help you. But that's, in this case, you're giving them that anonymized opportunity and aggregating the data. And you've kind of reported out on some of these findings, right? I think you on the blog and whatnot, and in evaluations, right?
That's right. So we reported out some of this on the blog. We also have this evaluation that is ongoing. It's a developmental evaluation. The next reports will be out this fall. And part of that as part of the evaluation for this latest round of reports, we actually took a deep dive on leadership transition, because there's a lot of leadership transition happening in the cohort. In that cohort of 340, we've already had more than 70 leadership transitions announced since Build began. And so we wanted to understand them better. We wanted to kind of understand what was happening, but we also wanted to understand how Build could support organizations through, you know, what can be a very rocky time as they transition into leadership. And, you know, one of the things that we have found is that the grantees who are experiencing leadership transition are telling us that flexible multi-year support is really essential to making sure those transitions are successful. Everything from having the funding to hire a recruiter to providing coaching to the new leader and the senior team. So that's really critical. We're also finding that when leadership transition is happening in Build, the new leader is more likely to be younger. That makes sense, of course. But they're more likely to be a woman and a person of color than the leader that they are replacing, right? And women of color have told us that they're experiencing unique challenges. They face all the usual challenges that come with being a new leader, and then those challenges are compounded by systemic racism and sexism. And so they really are needing additional support from their funders in the areas of fundraising, donor retention, communications, media training, introducing an equity lens into their organization's work. And so one of the things that we took away from that was we really needed to to intensify the support we're providing to those new women of color leaders. We developed a cohort specifically for them, and giving them tailored support and time together over a 9-month period. We made the participation in that cohort completely optional. Actually, all participation in any of the additional capacity building that we offer is optional. But most of the leaders that we invited, I think there were 26 new women of color leaders in the build cohort in the US, and 21 of them said yes within 24 hours of receiving the invitation. So this was clearly something they were feeling a need around.
They were ready to go.
Yeah, and so we provided that space and that support. And then again, we stepped out of it. We don't go to those convenings. We don't have any idea what's discussed. It is a completely safe space for these female leaders.
Yeah, I mean, that's huge. Both supporting women of color and people of color in leadership and all of the complexities that they face, and also those executive transition moments and helping organizations sort of get through those in a healthy manner is so crucial. And so it's terrific that you're sort of combining those issues. And that certainly came up in our talent justice research about the perspectives of people of color and people with recent immigration experience in their families coming to the U.S. of really just sort of, you know, having the challenge of getting funders to stick with them as incoming leaders and not sort of waiting to see if they succeed and therefore setting them up to fail. So that's, I'm sure that's critical support, financial and moral support.
Yeah. Time to hang back and say, yes, well, I want to see what this person is going to do or where they're going to take the organization. It's really the time to lean into that relationship, to increase your financial support if you can, and to ask the new leader, how can I help? And a lot of time what that help is introducing them to other donors, right? But it's also providing that sounding board for them when they ask for it, right? Not like being too overbearing about it, but being there to provide support when the new leader comes to you and says, I really need this.
Mm-hmm. Again, listening and responding. Yeah. Is there, as we kind of get to the end here, is there anything else you wanted to share about your experience or what you're doing at Build?
You know, I'll share one thing that I wish we were doing more of, because we really haven't focused on it. And we're starting to feel like it's our own blind spot, right? We focused a lot, because there were so many leadership transitions and so many really visionary people of color and women leaders, we really focused on the leaders or sometimes on the senior team. And I think our blind spot was not giving more attention specifically to issues of talent pipeline and developing talent within an organization. And, you know, partly it's just we couldn't do everything all at once and there's no harm in focusing. But I think as we start to think about what a second phase of Build might look like, and we're very optimistic we're going to get a chance to keep doing this for a while, really thinking about organizations are already using Build to invest in their own people. But how can we as Ford really invest in helping to build those pipelines? Because what we're seeing is that when a new leader, especially a person of color or a female leader, comes from within the organization, that tends to be a smoother transition. And it provides an unbelievably great example for others that, yeah, I can do that too, right? I can move up the ranks.
Yeah. That's terrific. Another person I've gotten to interview on this podcast is Tom Adams, who helped start Transition Guides, which was a firm that just worked on nonprofit executive transitions. And they were started sort of by Annie Casey and Kellogg to sort of when they started seeing those kinds of transitions happening with their grantees. And Tom wrote this book where he basically says, you can't recruit from within, you can't build strength at the top if you don't sort of build all the way and build a diverse, leaderful, he uses the term leaderful, organization, kind of at every rung on the ladder so that you build that bench, to use yet another mixed metaphor, so people can get out on the field or whatever.
Yeah, and I mean, it's not just good kind of like business and management theory to do that, right? It's an equity strategy. It's a social justice strategy. Like, if you really believe in the inherent value and dignity of every person, then no person in your own organization should be treated as expendable or an afterthought, right? You should really be thinking about how you invest in and develop each person and support them to reach their maximum potential, whether it's in your organization or in the next one that they go to, right?
That is a beautiful way to end the conversation. I think that was a great encapsulation of the values that I think we're sharing on this conversation. So thank you so much, Kathy. This was terrific.
Thanks, Rusty. This was a lot of fun.
And I wish you...
I appreciate the invitation.
Yes, yes. Glad to have you here. And we'll keep our listeners apprised of as that new evaluation is available, so and all the links that you mentioned on the website so that people can learn more. So thanks again.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Fund the People, a podcast with me, Rusty Stahl, where we amplify how and why philanthropy should support the nonprofit workforce. For links to the resources that were mentioned in this episode, check out our show notes and more at fundthepeople.org/podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show. And if you enjoyed the episode or you're a regular listener, please share the podcast with your network or at least with one or two colleagues who you believe would find it valuable. Thanks for all you do every day for our community and our country through your nonprofit work. Stick with it, keep your tank full, and take care of one another.